night. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Really glad to be here today and going to rush through it because we got a packed show. It's really a packed show this time out. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking a little bit about the times, and I'm going to read you a piece that basically puts before you what you're going to do, where you're going to go, and how you're looking at things. All right, so that's at the back end of that. I'll be reading that. And before that, we'll be hearing an interview with Markus Rindt, the director of the Dresden, Germany Symphony Orchestra, the Dresdener Symphoniker. The orchestra organized a major musical event on June 3rd on the Mexican side of the U.S.-Mexico border near San Diego. The event was called Tear Down This Wall, and it was organized to take a stand against policies of isolation, fanaticism, and nationalism. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing onto the show Bruce Cummings. And this is going to be part one of a two-part series I'm going to do with Bruce. And Bruce is a person who has spent his life studying Korea, and in particular North Korea, and what's going on between North Korea and the rest of the world. We're talking with Bruce on the real history of U.S. relations with North Korea, which has been a history of nonstop U.S. aggression. Bruce is the Gustavus F. and Ann M. Swift Distinguished Service Professor in History at the University of Chicago, and he's the author of many books, including The Korean War and Inventing the Axis of Evil and The Truth About North Korea and Syria. So let's just jump into it. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Back in late March, you wrote a piece titled, This is What's Really Behind North Korea's Nuclear Provocations. And you opened it up with a description of Trump having dinner with the Japanese prime minister, and that the dinner was disrupted by news that North Korea had fired off a new solid-fuel intermediate-range ballistic missile. And it was aimed towards Japan. Now, this was a huge thing in the news everywhere. There was a message in the missile that you pointed to. Let's talk about that.
Well, it was a very pointed message because Prime Minister Abe, having dinner at Mar-a-Lago with Trump, is the grandson of one of the most powerful Japanese leaders and politicians in the mid-20th century, Kishi Nobusuke. And in the 1930s, he was manufacturing munitions in the puppet state of Manchukuo, northeast China, or Manchuria, as we knew it at the time. And Kim Il-sung, who is, of course, the grandfather of the current North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, was fighting really for a decade against the Japanese in Manchuria. So that history, which is still very alive for both the Japanese and the North Koreans, is nonetheless hardly known at all in this country. The U.S. declared Mr. Kishi to be a Class A war criminal during our occupation of Japan after the war. He spent time in jail. But when he got out, the U.S. supported him to the hilt. He was one of the founders of the Liberal Democratic Party, which is the major party in Japan, a country that's had a kind of one-party rule going back to 1955 when the LDP was founded, I might add, with a lot of CIA money. And then Kishi was prime minister in the late 50s twice. So suddenly he goes from American enemy in World War II to big American friend. And the current prime minister, Abe, really reveres his grandfather. So the North Koreans made a very pointed comment just by the timing of this particular missile, but they did it again on Memorial Day. Nobody in this country ever points it out. I mean, they blew off an atomic bomb on Memorial Day during President Obama's first few months in office, and they launched a missile toward Japan on Memorial Day, the one we just had. So the North Koreans must have at least some aggravation that nobody seems to get their messages.
When it comes to nukes and nuclear weapons and the situation in North Korea versus South Korea, and of course standing in there, and really the principal character in a lot of this is the U.S. and what they've actually been orchestrating for decades now, many decades. And one of the things that you say in your part of the book, Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria, you argue that the U.S., in fact, today, when it's talking about all this stuff around the North Koreans are terrorizing people, there's news that they've just fired off another missile down towards Japan and all this stuff, and it's really making it seem like they're just frothing at the mouth and raring to go. You make a point in your book that I thought was important for people to understand, and it's something that never does ever come out, which is that the United States terrorized North Korea with nuclear weapons during and after the Korean War, and was the only power to introduce nuclear weapons to Korean soil. So there's a lot that's just unknown by people, even as they sit there and are fed all this stuff about how the North Koreans are crazy and they're playing with nukes. And here you have the U.S. as being actually the progenitor of all this.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit like the invasion of Iraq in 2003, where most people, including a lot of liberals, accepted the fact that Saddam Hussein was a vicious dictator who had WMDs. And there was no real background given to, for example, our support of Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and the war with Iran. Then we have a war, and the war goes very badly. It's still a complete catastrophe. And all this history comes out. And if we were to go to war with North Korea, which has seemed closer under the Trump administration than it has been in some time, all of this would come out about the U.S. running an operation called Hudson Harbor in 1951, where B-29s dropped dummy atomic bombs on North Korea to see whether they might be useful against troop concentrations in cities. President Eisenhower, toward the end of the war in May 1953, tested one of the largest atomic bombs ever tested and also shot the first atomic cannon. And this was all put on the front page of newspapers and was intended to bring an end to the war and intimidate North Korea and China. And then, as you said, in 1958, we installed hundreds of nuclear weapons, battlefield tactical weapons, and short-range warheads on missiles into South Korea. So we're the first one to introduce nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula and kept them there until 1991, when they were withdrawn on a world scale because the Pentagon felt that precision-guided high explosives but non-nuclear weapons would cause fewer problems. You wouldn't have radiation and collateral damage from nuclear weapons. So we drew them back. But you can leave it to Donald Trump to tell you what the North Koreans still face, which is, for example, a Trident submarine, sometimes called Armageddon, in one sausage tube. He mentioned that two of our nuclear submarines, were off of North Korea last week. This is, of course, classified information. He's not supposed to say that. He doesn't know that. But the fact is that one of our nuclear submarines, or all of them, could run right up to the North Korean coast and obliterate North Korea in a matter of hours. Colin Powell, back in 1995, which should give your listeners an idea of how long this problem has been going on. It's really 25 years we've been dealing with the North Korean nuclear problem. Colin Powell said if they ever used a nuclear weapon in anger, the U.S. would turn North Korea into a charcoal briquette. I just want to say one more thing about that. If you imagine North Korea as the green team against the blue team rather than the evil Kim Jong-un with his crazy haircut against the always perfect United States, you can see what they're up against. It's a small country, and the largest power in the world is constantly threatening it with nuclear annihilation. President Obama did this, too. He routinely sent nuclear-capable B-1 and B-2 bombers over South Korea for exercises. So it's a very dangerous situation, and I think it's incumbent upon Americans to put themselves in the shoes of the North Koreans and look at the world that they face, quite apart from all of our media stereotypes about how crazy they are and how dangerous they are.
Which brings us right to this, too, because when you want to talk about crazy and dangerous, you say that the North Korea, would not have had nukes if the U.S. had actually kept its word in the past.
People who follow this situation closely and high officials in the Clinton administration, like Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Wendy Sherman, her very close aide on North Korea, have written about this. Bill Clinton nearly struck North Korea with a preemptive attack against their nuclear facility in June 1994. It was only later that people realized or came to understand how close we were to a war with North Korea at that time. But Jimmy Carter intervened when he heard about all of this. He flew to Pyongyang and talked directly with Kim Il-sung and got a freeze on all of North Korea's plutonium. It's very important to underline that freeze was completely monitored and checked for 8 years, 24/7. You had UN inspectors on the grounds, closed circuit cameras watching it at all times. The reactors were sealed. And of course, we know with our intelligence when a reactor starts up. So there's no question the North Koreans didn't have an ounce of plutonium from 1994 to 2002. However, George Bush had already put North Korea in his axis of evil in 2002, and then in September he announced his preemptive doctrine, which the euphemism was anticipatory self-defense, and North Korea, along with Iran and especially Iraq, were listed as the countries for which this policy was developed. He then went ahead, of course, to invade Iraq in March of 2003, which was really a preventive war rather than anticipatory self-defense. I mean, we don't need to get into this, but Saddam Hussein was actually writing a novel at the time and trying to do everything he could not to provoke the U.S. After that happened, North Korea just said as openly and loudly as it could, Saddam Hussein didn't have nuclear weapons. If he had them, he wouldn't have been overthrown. That's not going to happen to us. And they systematically began building. They got back their plutonium, kicked out the inspectors, and systematically began building atomic weapons and tested the first one just 3 years later in 2006. I don't think it's a partisan judgment, but a factual statement to say that George W. Bush has two enormous catastrophes on his hands. One is the invasion of Iraq, which basically wrecked the Middle East since 2003. And second, he is the primary person responsible for North Korea getting nuclear weapons. And I think many experts believe that. Madeleine Albright has written about that. But it doesn't get out in the media at all, in part because so many of our people want to say, well, it's six of one, half dozen of the other, or not to sound partisan.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Professor Bruce Cummings. And Bruce is an American historian of East Asia, professor, lecturer, and author, and he's at the University of Chicago, and he specializes in modern Korean history and contemporary international relations. Bruce, let me ask you this. As we're talking about this, basically it seems to be a fact that the U.S. has not paid any attention at all to what the North Koreans have actually done in relation to all the various agreements around missiles and nukes. It seems like they just keep steamrolling in a way to push in a certain direction. They're just going to go after North Korea to take it out.
Well, that is generally true of more recent administrations, but the Clinton administration, after toying with the idea of attacking North Korea, as I said, froze their nuclear facility for 8 years. And then from 1998 to 2000, William Perry, Clinton's former defense secretary, became a kind of roving ambassador for North Korea. And along with South Korea, whose president, Kim Dae-jung, had started an engagement policy with North Korea. For 2 years, you had talks on a whole host of subjects, ending the Korean War, getting rid of their plutonium once and for all, and basically buying out their medium and long-range missiles indirectly. This was a terribly important agreement that was signed, in effect, in October 2000, when a very high North Korean general, Cho Myung-nok, who was responsible for their conglomerate that builds their missiles, came to the White House, met with Bill Clinton, Cho having his full military regalia on, and they signed an agreement saying neither country would have hostile intentions toward the other. And if Clinton would go to Pyongyang to meet with then-leader Kim Jong-il, North Korea would mothball its missiles and enter the missile technology control regime, which would limit their missiles to 300 kilometers. Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State at the time, then went to North Korea in late October, met with Kim Jong-il to work on this deal. But then, of course, we had the 2000 election, and for 6 weeks we didn't know who was going to be president. And when the Supreme Court gave it to George Bush, his people said they didn't like that agreement. You can just read Madam Albright's memoirs to see how flabbergasted she was by that, because North Korea would not have the missiles that they keep blowing off if we had followed through on that agreement. I mean, the Bush administration, the W. Bush administration, really has a lot to answer for, not only in allowing North Korea to get hold of its plutonium again, but in allowing this missile deal to drop between the stools. Now, Obama was better in the sense that he did try to initiate talks with North Korea in 2012, but he also put North Korea kind of on the back burner among the country's pariah states, let's say, that he wanted to open relations with, Cuba, Burma, Iran, and even Laos. And he never got around to North Korea. And as I said before, he also frequently lofted these B-1 bombers over the South just to let the North Koreans know who's boss.
One of the things, though, that you talk about, too, in this number of articles, where you talk about most recently the use of agreements, et cetera, have been kicked to the curb, that there's an assumption that no one has been able to rein in the nuts in North Korea and their nuke program, and it's time to fight or topple. Let's talk about that.
People routinely say North Korea has always cheated and never has kept to its agreements, and I don't know where they're coming from because it's simply not true. In addition to the plutonium agreement, the freeze, and the missile deal, North Korea in 2000 also opened relations with many of our allies, so they have diplomatic relations with Canada and Great Britain, France, Germany, Italy. We're one of the last countries not to have relations with North Korea, still trying to isolate it. But the fact is, North Korea was really reaching out, and then they faced a wall of hostility from Bush. It is true that if we continue to intimidate North Korea with nuclear weapons and bring them into the theater by submarines and air power, anybody in North Korea would get a deterrent. In that sense, the critics of North Korea are right that North Korea, when it felt intimidated over many, many years, eventually developed nuclear weapons. It might have happened anyway, but the fact is we did have agreements with them that kept them from moving to nuclear weapons. Finally, I would say, in response to your question, that the discourse about North Korea under Trump has just been absurd, in that Trump, as I said, talked about our nuclear submarines off the coast. He has threatened North Korea. He's also said he'd like to talk to Kim Jong-un over a hamburger. That might be the better way to go. But he's so erratic, and the one thing that the North Koreans notice is the submarines, the two aircraft carrier task forces that are in Northeast Asian waters right now. What Trump has done privately or secretly, and what the Pentagon has done, is just jam a bunch of hardware up against North Korea. Meanwhile, our press, and that includes not Fox News, but CNN and MSNBC, are constantly running scare stories about North Korea. I saw on CNN that Anna Navarro, one of their frequent commentators, even referred to Kim by his first name, saying little boy Un is a maniac. She probably thought that was his last name, but that's the level of discourse that we've had about North Korea under Trump.
And related to that, you've pointed out that North Korea is the only country in the world to have been systematically blackmailed by U.S. nukes going all the way back to the 50s. When you're looking at this, all these other places that have developed some form of nuclear weaponry or are trying to get it, and then the main focus is on North Korea. Why?
That generalization wouldn't have held up if we looked at China in the 50s and early 60s before they got nuclear weapons. We were doing the same thing to China, intimidating them, blackmailing them, that we did to North Korea, and nearly got into a war over some tiny islands in 1958 with China. You might also say that Iran has been similarly intimidated, but we have not been close to war with Iran, nor have we fought a war with Iran. But with North Korea, we fought a bloody war for 3 years. We've had 72 years of conflict with them, going back to the initial American occupation of Southern Korea in 1945. And China, once it got its own nuclear weapons, of course, we weren't in a position to do much about that. It creates a kind of Mexican standoff for nuclear deterrence. But with North Korea, we really have just decades of threatening this small country with nuclear weapons, and why should we be surprised when they finally want to get a deterrent of their own?
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Professor Bruce Cummings. And Bruce is an American historian of East Asia, professor, lecturer, and author, and he's at the University of Chicago, and he specializes in modern Korean history and contemporary international relations. Related to that, you have something like Leon Panetta's statement that we have been within an inch of war with the North Koreans for many months. And so then he advocated dropping these dummy bombs. This seems to be a constant edge of the North Koreans are actually living on the edge of what could be massive incineration and unbelievable havoc being wreaked on the Korean people.
If there were a new war in Korea, it would extend to Japan and all of our military bases in the region, including Guam, where we have huge installations and hundreds of bases in Japan and South Korea with almost 80,000 troops on the ground in Japan and South Korea, American troops. They would all be targeted by the North Koreans, and the North Koreans wouldn't win this war, but they would absolutely devastate the region. And that's why there is no military solution to the problems in Korea. There never has been, as we learned in the Korean War when it ended in a stalemate. Leon Panetta's statement is particularly worrisome because it was during the Obama administration. He told CNN in 2011, just as you said, we'd been within an inch of war with North Korea for months on end. And this went back to 2010 when there were skirmishes in what Koreans call the West Sea and everybody else calls the Yellow Sea on the western midriff of the Korean Peninsula. There are clashes there all the time, particularly in May and June when the crabbing season begins and North and South Korean fishing boats get into conflict with each other. There's also a northern limit line in the sea that the U.S. and South Korea recognize, but North Korea has never recognized it. And Henry Kissinger, when he was Secretary of State, said it was totally illegal under international law. So you don't have a demilitarized zone or a line that everybody recognizes. Instead, you have a kind of free-for-all there. And in 2010, it escalated to the point where the North Koreans took out a South Korean ship, a naval ship, and killed more than 30 of their sailors. And that ratcheted up the tension a great deal, and it's what led in 2011 to Panetta's statement. But it's absolutely ridiculous to imagine a general war in the region breaking out because of crabbing ground conflicts and a situation in the sea there that should long ago have been resolved, getting a North Korean agreement to where their boats can go and where South Korean boats can go.
You've also made a point, and I think this is really important, that there's a whole different perception of the problem, the source of danger in relation to nukes in Korea. And it's sort of that, you know, there's an epistemology that sort of is always bad no matter when it's used, which is based on everybody knows, you know, and that is a very dangerous thing in relation to this. In reality, there's a long history, as you've been saying, to nuclear threats against North Korea itself. In fact, the U.S. has recently installed the THAAD missile defense system in South Korea. Let's talk about those two things.
Well, that was one of the more cynical ploys on the part of the United States in recent years. This terminal high altitude area defense system was jammed into South Korea while the current president, at the time President Park Geun-hye, was being impeached, and before the election that was held earlier this month, which brought a progressive to power. And the U.S. fears that Moon Jae-in, the new president, will be an engager of North Korea, like his mentor, Nomu-hyun, who was president from 2002 to 2007. And so they wanted to get that system in and installed before the new president came into office. And he just complained last week that four launchers were brought in without his permission or without his office being notified about that. In other words, we are continuing to add to the system even after he's president without telling him. It's just an outrageous situation in our relationship with South Korea. We hardly ever have problems with the ruling party that goes back to the dictators, but we always have problems with liberals and progressives who want to try a different approach toward North Korea. The only time that has not been true is when Bill Clinton and William Perry brought American policy around to engagement for 2 years, 1998 to 2000. That's the only time we've had direct talks with the North Koreans that have really yielded so much. But I would expect that President Trump is not going to like President Moon very well, and you'll see a lot of tension in their relationship, just as there was between George W. Bush and Nomu-hyun in the early 2000s. I want to say one more thing about the THAAD system. It's really designed not to knock down North Korean missiles. North Korea has short and medium-range missiles that it can launch by the dozens, and there's no way this THAAD system can knock them down. It's really there to monitor North Korean long-range missiles and Chinese missile tests and long-range missiles, and the Chinese have complained mightily about this. I think the THAAD system's installation in South Korea was primarily political in that it was trying to get it in there before a progressive president was elected and to do what the U.S. has been trying to do for many, many years, which is to weld South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. together in an alignment or an alliance to contain China. It doesn't really have much to do at all with the so-called North Korean threat, but it has a lot to do with off China and, you know, making sure the system's in there before a president comes to power who might not like it.
One more question, Bruce. Just how dangerous is this situation, both in terms of war and even the impact of war on human survival?
Well, I'm in touch with 30 or 40 people who work on North Korea, former government officials, scholars. Somehow North Korea has become a big deal. We have 15 or 20 websites dealing with it now that we never had 10 or 15 years ago. But in the last couple of months, I've seen time and again very well-informed experts worrying about the U.S. and North Korea coming to blows. It could come from an incident that ratchets up into a war, or it could come from a preemptive attack. And there was a great deal of talk back in March and April about Trump people favoring a preemptive attack on North Korea on its missiles. You can't really attack their nuclear facilities preemptively, or you'll lose a hell of a lot of radiation around the region. There was almost a consensus inside the Beltway in the fall and winter that if North Korea keeps moving toward an ability to hit the United States with a long-range missile and a nuclear weapon, we just have to think about preempting that. And it's very, very dangerous because along the DMZ there have been cycles of preemption and counter-preemption both happening and envisioned by the respective militaries, North and South Korea and the U.S., going back decades, going back to the Korean War. So to add the threat of a preemptive attack on North Korea's missiles is just to really come close to bringing forth the general war in the region that we talked about.
All right, Bruce Cummings, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. Bruce Cummings, and Bruce is an American historian of East Asia, professor, lecturer, and author. He teaches at the University of Chicago, and he specializes in modern Korean history and contemporary international relations. And we've been talking about what the hell the U.S. is doing in relation to North Korea, and what danger does it pose for the Korean people and for humanity as a whole. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. It's hard to stop that one, but we got to roll along. That's At the Drive-In with Governed by Contagion. I recently had the opportunity to speak with Markus Rindt, the director of the Dresden Germany Symphony Orchestra, the Dresdener Symphoniker. On June 3rd, the orchestra organized a major musical and artistic event called Tear Down This Wall, which was organized to take a stand against policies of isolation, fanaticism, and nationalism. It was originally scheduled to be held at the Friendship Park on the U.S. side of the border with Mexico and simultaneously on the Mexican side near San Diego. But the event was denied a permit from the U.S. Border Patrol for reasons we'll get into. So here's my conversation with Markus Rindt. Markus, welcome to the show.
Hi, how's Michael?
Hi. Good to have you, man. Been looking forward to this for quite a while. Now, as I was telling people, you were actually key to this event that happened on June 3rd. Down along the U.S.-Mexican border in Southern California. And it was on June 3rd. It was originally planned as a protest performance against Trump's protectionist course, everything that he's doing around from attacking Muslims to attacking Mexican people trying on both sides of the border, people trying to come in and people who have been here for ages and deporting people like crazy, all of this kind of stuff. And you actually called this event. So tell people the event, and you're part of the Dresdener Symphoniker. And you called an event at the border, and I thought it was really important for people to know what that was. So tell us, give us a little bit of idea of what that was.
Yeah, it was actually an idea to have an event, a concert, on both sides of this wall. We planned the concert simultaneously on both sides. On the Mexican side, there would have been the Dresden Symphonica and Mexican musicians. And on the other side, on the U.S. side, we would have had American musicians. But we didn't get the permission in the end. We tried for weeks, and we didn't succeed. It was quite sad. And in the end, we did this event on the 3rd of June, only on the Mexican side. So actually, this is not meant to be only against this wall, against this planned wall of President Trump, or this real existing wall in some places between U.S. and Mexico. It is also a statement against the walls of people's minds around the world and also against the rising walls around Europe and in other places in the world, which is quite sad to see how the refugees dying in the Mediterranean Sea every day, and so the same on the border between Syria and Turkey. So that's why I wanted to take a stand against this increasing isolation worldwide. So that's the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very important, a very good idea. So what were you trying to do at the border before they refused your permission to do it? What was it exactly that you were trying to do?
Yeah, the first plan actually was to position two groups of musicians on both sides and to play together, which has been very difficult because the American musicians would have to hold a distance of 40 yards from the fence. And but we decided to do this anyway, or regardless of that. And we commissioned a composer from Germany to compose a piece which takes this in consideration to play with this distance, like answering question, yeah? So we tried to organize this event, but unfortunately, the American side didn't give us the permission, and we had to change the plan, and we invited the U.S. musicians to Tijuana, and some of them came, and we had a huge festival on the 3rd of June with, I think, maybe 100 musicians and artists, or maybe even more, and 2,000 people in the audience. The whole day, different groups of music was in between classical music, choir, youth orchestra, punk bands, rock bands, and the Jazz Symphonica. And the group of the Jazz Symphonica, we were not a full-size orchestra in Tijuana, only a group, but it was a very successful event, I think.
When they refused you permission to have the concert on the U.S. side of the border, they apparently said something to you about endangering birds and being worried about security concerns for children. What do you think of that?
So, at the first, when we applied the first time to perform in the International Friendship Park, this place where you can come very close together from both sides, they said they have security reason and didn't give us the permission for this children's choir. Then we had to change the venue. We chose the beach. And the beach is also very nice. And you have this wall. It's going into the sea. But you can look through the fence. And it would have been a good place to perform together. And about 3 weeks ago, we got an email that they refuse to give us the permission due to bird breeding protection and also security reason. Normally I'm a fan of animal protection, of course, yeah. But if you consider that 1 week before our event, there has been another very big event of the American side, on the American side, and they got the permission, and they had even more participants, and that makes the thing for me quite clear that it's not the actual reason. And also security reasons. I mean, nobody spoke with us. We could have worked on a solution to have more security or police, or maybe to close the street to the beach to make sure that it's not dangerous. But nobody spoke to us. We only got this email that we cannot perform there. And I think it's not this reason. It's the title of the project, Tear Down This Wall. The title is borrowed, a quote, by President Reagan. He told Mikhail Gorbachev exactly 30 years ago. So I think it was on the 12th or 13th of June in 1987. And he told him, Mikhail Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And he meant this Berlin Wall. And 2 years later, the wall came down. We were absolutely happy. I grew up in East Germany. I remember this very well, and this quote by Ronald Reagan is meant to be against all political wars in the world. It's not especially this war between Mexico and the United States. It's very important for me to emphasize.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's something I wanted to ask you in relation to that, because you also, basically, you've made statements about how the purpose of this was much bigger, much more soaring than, you know, anything that the U.S. government was probably accusing you of or trying to say that you were going to cause, you were going to do. You talked about it being against nationalism and against isolationism. And actually, as you've already mentioned a little, I want to explore a little bit more, tearing down the walls literally and figuratively in terms of this question of nationalism, isolationism, and the walls that are set up in people's heads. Let's talk a little bit about your thinking around that.
Yeah, also this project is also against the walls in people's minds. And you see these rising nationalism in France, And in, for example, in Great Britain, we have this in many, many countries in the world. And I'm quite worried. I remember very well when the wall came down in between East Germany and West Germany. That was a fantastic time. We were so happy that the people in the GDR, or the East German people, had achieved with peaceful protest to tear down a wall or to remove a system, this communist system, that was extraordinary in history. And now we see the opposite again. The Western countries are quite concerned, or they are afraid of the refugees who come from the South countries or from Africa or from civil war countries like Syria, Iraq. But the right to apply for asylum is a human right, and it is very important that we help those poor people who try to rescue their life, that we help them and not to look away. And that's why I want to bring this subject back in people's minds. So let's talk about other solutions. Let's find other solutions, not closed borders, not more and more and more and higher walls around Europe or other countries. So this is also important between Turkey and Syria. I got this information some days ago that President Erdogan is planning to build a wall between Turkey and Iraq, Turkey-Iran, and Turkey and Syria, of course. This is not acceptable. The musicians or artists come together, you can achieve maybe something what politicians cannot achieve sometimes. And it's all, maybe it's only a try, but it's worth a try. And it could be a start. For me, it would be the greatest result of this project if some artists around the world would take the same title and initiate their own activity in another country. It is not necessary. If it's a wall, it can always be a different, I don't know.
All right, that's very cool. Let's explore a little bit more. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I've been talking with Markus Rindt, the director of the Dresden Germany Symphony Orchestra, the Dresdener Symphoniker. On June 3rd, the orchestra organized and participated in a major musical and artistic event, Tear Down This Wall. I wanted to ask you a little bit about this, because when you're talking about, first of all, let's talk about again, you started to speak to this a little earlier, but I'd like to hear a little bit more. So you had the event, you had the concert, and it was on the Tijuana side of the border. How did that go?
It went fantastically. So when I, the first time when I thought about this idea, or when I developed this idea, I had this idea to come to the border, to play a piece, only one song, and go back to Mexico where we had a tour. Now we are on tour in Mexico. But in the end, it was a huge festival. I didn't expect it to become a huge festival, but it was surprising to see how many musicians and artists, not only musicians and also artists, came together. They painted the wall. They had some very interesting art things on the wall, and a lot of different music, and the atmosphere was so fantastic all the day. So I can really say it was a huge success. And even if you consider that we got a lot of hate mails also from people who think that it was only against this wall or some pro walls, yeah. Of course, we are free, we are liberal, everyone can think what he likes, and but it is also quite sad to see that we get really insulting emails every day.
Let me ask you this, because this really intrigued me. I read somewhere where you were going to use the fence that's along the U.S.-Mexican border as a percussion instrument in your performance. Did that actually happen?
Yeah, that happened. When I was the first time in Tijuana exploring the venue, I saw that the wall is consisting of, and I got this idea inspired by one American musician, Glenn Wyant. he's a percussionist, and he used the wall since years as a percussion instrument. I thought we could extend this to this part on the ocean, and to have a lot of percussionists who use the wall as a percussion instrument to transform it into an instrument, and at the same time have a band improvising music on the wall, very close to the wall, and it worked very well. We had huge cans and iron trash, metal trash from a recycling place, and we attached these things on the wall, used a lot of things like hammers and other things to make noise, to make music on the wall, and then they changed to the venue or to the stage and played together with the musicians of the Christmas Symphonica, the percussionists also using iron trash on stage. And this piece was premiered. It was composed by a German composer, Harald Thiemann, our drummer. And I like this piece very much. It's a very energetic piece and sounded fantastic.
Mm-hmm. You also played, I understand.
And we had also...
Go ahead.
Yeah, we had also another premiere in the end. So there was a youth orchestra, Sinfonica Juvenil from Tijuana, and a choir from Tijuana. And in the end, we collected all the musicians, or almost all the musicians, together on the stage, and we performed a song. It was called Beyond by Wieland Reismann, composer from Cologne. He composed this song it was written in Spanish and English, and two very nice and very good singers from Guatemala and Mexico, they performed the song step by step. The orchestra and the band and the choir came in and joined them, and that was the finale, and it was a very emotional piece in the end.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read also that, actually, this is just a quick question, but I read also that you guys had planned to play pieces from bands like Santana and Los Bandwan and Pink Floyd and Frank Zappa. Did that happen?
Yeah, we performed Frank Zappa and Santana, of course. It's part of our program. We have also here in Mexico on tour, and some old pieces by our Argentinian saxophone player. He composed some songs. And the program was not classical music, but it was quite pop and rock music, because we are now on tour as a huge band, or not huge, mm-hmm. as a big band, yeah. And that's why we chose exactly this program for the wall as well. And I think it was also a good decision, because we used amplification, and on the other side, of the wall, there were some people from the U.S. who demonstrated pro-wall, who demonstrated with transparent, let's build the wall like this, and they made some noise, but we had an amplification and we were louder.
Mm-hmm. Good. Now, the Dresdner Symphoniker Ensemble is known apparently for combining contemporary music with a lot of social political issues. Let's talk about that. Like, you've done a number of concerts around the world, and this idea of combining this music with social political issues, let's talk about that.
Yeah, I'm very interested in politics around the world when I travel and I talk with people, so the problems come to me, and so the ideas are developed, yeah, by talking with people. And so we have so many problems in the world. For example, last year we did a project with Armenian and Turkish musicians commemorating the Armenian genocide. So it was a project of reconciliation to have an orchestra from German, Armenian, and Turkish musicians playing together Armenian, Turkish, and German music to start a dialogue. Because there is actually no dialogue between Turkey and Armenia. And this is since, I think, 100 years. And we wanted to start this dialogue with music. And the project was, it was called Aret. Aret means catastrophe in Armenia. It's quite a synonym like Holocaust in Germany. And it was very successful because a lot of people in Europe noticed that we did this project. Turkey protested against us. And with this protest, they made this project even bigger and more important. You see, it is so important to do this such project. Music can move some things, mm-hmm. I think. This is my, how to say, I believe in that. Also, we had a project in 2013. We made a tour to the West Bank with Israeli and Palestinian musicians in the orchestra. It was called a symphony for Palestine. And also this is very important. There we have this wall between the occupied region, Palestine and Israel, and it's important to find solutions for the future, and it's also very good to have these musicians and artists in an orchestra from different nations. You learn a lot about their problems when you travel to these countries, and yeah, we can inform our audience in Germany about these problems. For example, in Germany, a lot of people didn't know that there is already a wall between Mexico and the United States. They believe it is only a plan, and some, not all, but there are a lot of people who believe that. And I think it's important to show the reality, because you have families or you have people who came from Mexico who applied for the green card or for asylum. And if they would go back to Mexico, they would lose this application. It would be over for them. So they have the only chance to meet with their relatives on this friendship park. This is a very emotional place. They can put their fingers through the fence. It's very narrow. And you see, if you stand there, if you see this, it's very touching to see. You see a lot of crying people and small children who held the fingers of their relatives, of their maybe fathers, for example. And if you see this and you show this to the audience around the world with a project like ours, then it's a result we got with this.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, I have two more questions for you. One is, well, basically, you mentioned, I saw an interview you did, and you mentioned that the actions of the U.S. government in relation to canceling the attempt to have the concert on the U.S. side of the wall, you know, with all the phony reasons that they were putting out and all this other stuff. But you also said beyond all that, you said when you sat back and thought about it, that actually this poses some very serious questions for you in terms of the freedom of people to think in the U.S., the freedom of musicians to create, the freedom, basically the freedom of the arts in the U.S. You seem to be saying that to you, that was actually all being called into question in this country, if this kind of thing can happen.
Yeah, and the beach where we planned to do this, so on both sides, on the beach, this beach is a public area. You can walk from San Diego to the wall on the beach. And why shouldn't it be possible to make music on the wall, to have cross-border performance? I cannot understand this. Of course, I could understand if there are people who demolish maybe something or disturb the nature or something like this. But it's beach. It's on beach, and we planned to have, or we planned only 25 artists on the American side. That's actually not much. And if you consider that the wall is huge on this place, I mean, the wall is not very good for birds and for bird protection, or like they say, bird breeding protection. good. The wall itself, it's not good. And our performance would be so such a small disturbance compared to this wall. And that's my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you see this, I can only say that the art is not so free anymore in the United States like it has been. And I hope it will be so free and liberal like it was in the future again.
As we get set to go out, I want to ask you one more question, actually, I guess, is where can people find out more about the Dresdener Sinfonica?
Yeah, we have a website. This website is called Dresdner-Sinfonica.de. And also we have a Vimeo channel. There's a lot of media content from different former projects. It's they have to Google Dresdner Sinfonica and Vimeo, yeah? And you find a lot of videos and audios. And also we have a Twitter account. This Twitter account is called Dresden Symphony. So, and also Facebook. So there are a lot of possibilities to explore what we did in the past.
Okay, and is there any chance you would be coming to the States to do a tour?
Oh, I would like to. So I love the USA. And I have been also in L.A. some years ago. And yeah, I would like to come and to make a tour. It's not necessary that we always combine music and political issues. That's not necessary. We have sometimes also simply musical projects with good music, yeah, with great pieces. I'm a big fan of American composers, for example, John Adams, Steve Reich, like this. And I would like to do a project with American musicians on tour through America. That would be great.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, I thank you.
Yeah, Marcus, it was really, really interesting talking with you. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I've been talking with Marcus Rindt, the director of the Dresden, Germany Symphony Orchestra, the Dresdener Sinfoniker. On June 3rd, the orchestra organized and participated in a major musical and artistic event called Tear Down This Wall, which took place on the Mexican side of the U.S.-Mexican border, and it was taking a stand against policies of isolation, fanaticism, and nationalism all over the world. And in light of everything that's happening in the world, I want to read a part of the call to action from refusefascism.org and play an announcement of an upcoming protest to drive out the Trump-Pence regime. No. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. Drive out the Trump-Pence regime. The Trump-Pence regime is a fascist regime, not insult or exaggeration. This is what it is. For the future of humanity and the planet, we, the people, must drive this regime out. Donald Trump and Mike Pence have assembled a vicious cabal that has put forth positions and begun initiatives which demonstrate that they fully intend to shred political and social norms with catastrophic consequence. Because Trump has his finger on the nuclear trigger, the Trump-Pence regime is more dangerous to the world than even Hitler. Fascism has direction and momentum. Dissent is piece by piece criminalized. The truth is bludgeoned. Group after group is demonized and targeted along a trajectory that leads to real horrors. All of this has already begun under the Trump regime. History has shown that fascism must be stopped before it becomes too late. Millions of people outraged by this regime took to the streets, delivering a stinging rebuke to Trump the day after the inauguration. Protest and resistance continues against the many attacks of the people by the Trump-Pence administration. This must grow broader, deeper, and more determined. This resistance is righteous and necessary, but it is not sufficient. We must recognize that the character of fascism is that it can absorb separate acts of resistance while continually throwing the opposition off balance by rapidly moving its agenda forward. The Trump-Pence regime will repeatedly launch new highly repressive measures, eventually clamping down on all resistance and remaking the law, if they are not driven from power. Fascism is not just a gross combination of horrific reactionary policies. It is a qualitative change in how society is governed. Fascism foments and relies on xenophobic nationalism, racism, misogyny, and the aggressive reinstitution of oppressive traditional values. In Trump's election campaign, he encouraged and fed on the threat and use of violence to build a movement and come to power. In his inaugural address, he pledged allegiance only to this movement. What is critical to understand is that once in power, fascism essentially eliminates the traditional democratic rights. Even as the Trump-Pence regime is moving fast, they have not yet fully consolidated their regime, or, as yet, been able to implement their full program. But this is their objective, and it is very possible. It might only take a single serious crisis, international or domestic, for this regime to drop the hammer. We do not have much time. That's from the call to action, and you can find it at refusefascism.org. They just announced nationwide protests on July 15th, and I'll play the announcement from their Facebook page.
If you're unsatisfied or angered by the sessions hearing today, you should be. We in Refuse Fascism have a message for you. I'm one of the volunteers who interrupted Jeff Sessions at his initial confirmation hearing. And at that time, we already knew him to be the racist KKK supporter that he is. And since then, he's called Mexicans filth at the border. He's taken the gloves off of the police.
This is enough. We have to say no more in the name of humanity. We refuse to accept a fascist America. What he is doing, what Jeff Sessions is doing, he is part of an entire fascist regime that is looking to remake society, that is looking to clamp down on all of the resistance, that's looking to impose a fascist kind of rule. And one of the things that we know from Nazi Germany is that you have to go out and you have to drive out fascism before it's too late. This is why we're calling on you. July 15th, if you were at the Women's March, if you were at the Climate's March, if you were at the March for Science, you need to come out into the street and you need to join us. July 15th. No, Trump and Pence must go. A mass political protest. Trump and Pence are fascists. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. Come out, raise your voice. We have to say no. This stops right here. These hearings, if you've been watching these hearings, you see that nothing is going to come out of it unless we the people come out in the streets and fight on this together. Come out July 15th. No. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. We must move heaven and earth to drive out this regime because the future of humanity and the planet is what's at stake.
All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and as always, the wacky and wonderful Kiana Williams. All right, she's over there. It makes it a great pleasure to come in every time I come in. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to do something a little different today. We're going to go out with some of the sounds from the June 3rd Tear Down This Wall event at the U.S.-Mexico border. Talk to you again next week.